At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome to the Two Mics on the Record. It's yet another opportunity to listen to our soon-to-be award-winning podcast series, which has been going on for some time now. We're over 5 million listens, heading up towards 6 million listens. And I'm Mike Graham. You are?
I am Mike Porky Parry.
And this is the Two Mics on the Record Porky Parry review of books. This is where you tell us what books you've been reading.
It's a book review. I get sent books all the time, folks, okay?
Well, you never give me any of them.
Well, I never give you any of them because I don't think you're a literary individual.
Well, I am.
I think books would be wasted on you.
I am actually writing a book.
You keep saying I'm writing a book.
I'm
you've never had a book published, mate. I'm a published author in the Sunday Times bestseller list. So I don't really regard you on the same sort of level as me, so that's why I never pass any books on to you, okay?
Well, I mean, it's true to say that there are no books that I've written available for sale on Amazon for one penny.
Because nobody would buy any book that you wrote anyway.
I think
would you write a book about? You've nothing to write a book about.
Well, I'm writing a book about my life.
Your life, like anybody gives a stuff about your life.
Unlike you. Well, it's not so much about me as it's about the people that I've met.
Yeah.
And unlike you, I can remember what my life has been like, and you obviously can't.
Oh, you can? Oh, right, really? Well, I can remember most of my life.
I don't suffer from brain fog.
Apart from the intrusions you've made into it, you know, it's usually been disastrous.
I don't suffer from brain fog as you do. Mm. I don't suffer from sciatica as you do. I don't suffer from diabetes too.
I suffer from brain fog because of the amount of intense thinking and application I put into my daily life.
You've literally worn your brain out, have you?
What?
Have you worn your brain out?
It's overworking. It's working overtime. Yeah. There's no
doubt
about
that. Do you think you're sitting too far away from your microphone?
No, it's not too far away from my microphone. Right. I know exactly how close to come to a microphone and how close not to.
All right.
And if there was a problem, you know, one of those highly efficient technical guys who look after us from the control room would have told me by now.
Hey, Porky.
Yes.
Do you ever read The Economist?
I certainly do. It's one of my favourite journals.
Really? And why do you read The Economist?
Well, do you know what? The Economist, people think finance, business and all that. It's much, much more than that. It gets right to the point. Cuts through the noise, as you can call it, you know what I mean? That stuff that sometimes fogs your brain. Gets right to the point. I didn't realise until the last copy I picked up and I was looking at the, you know, the antecedents. 170 years it's been around, right? And I would call that trusted, intelligent information.
Yeah, well, it never stops asking questions and it wants to know why the world is the way it is, which is kind of what I want to know as well. I always want to know what the story is behind the story, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so do I as well. And let me tell you this, when I say it's much more than business and finance, it's got art, it's got science, it's got reviews.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an altogether very, very meaty read. However, there are, of course, major stories that The Economist look at which shape the world and which are affecting the world now. And the one in this week's edition that really got me is the situation in Venezuela.
Oh, it's awful.
Because,
isn't it?
My goodness me, that is a crisis of huge proportions.
Yeah.
Now, I've seen bits and pieces in the papers about Venezuela.
Yeah.
The Economist get right to the heart of it again, the suffering of the people in Venezuela.
Yeah.
The fact that now the people who are trying to run that country, Maduro, are losing the backing and the faith of the rest of the world, big style. And it doesn't surprise me when inside this fantastically detailed story you find that inflation is going up in the millions.
Yeah.
I mean, literally we're talking about 1.7 million%, and the people there are now so poor they're scraping around on rubbish tips. And even a report of people digging up bodies to recover jewellery from the dead.
It's shocking. But you know what's also interesting about The Economist is they go behind the stories as well.
Right.
And one of the people that I knew, not terribly well, but I knew quite well, was Marie Colvin, the woman who was killed in Syria covering the war.
We've had a drink with her
and they've got a great piece called A Private War.
Yes.
And it's all about Marie Colvin's unique type of bravery. And these are the people that you and I have rubbed shoulders with, war correspondents who have put their lives in danger.
Absolutely.
Sometimes fatally.
Yeah.
And ended up dead because they've challenged, you know, the views of some dictator or other in some dreadful part of the world.
Indeed, and I've read that piece, by the way, and it touches on the fact that her family have fought this battle against the Syrian authorities, accusing them of murder.
Yeah.
And it looks very much like they have come across information now, which could force the Syrians to, for the first time, admit their culpability.
Exactly right. Now, you can get a free print copy of The Economist.
Yep.
All you've got to do is just text this word, RECORD, R-E-C-O-R-D, to 78070.
Yes.
Tell them that again.
I'm going to. For your free print copy of The Economist, just text RECORD, R-E-C-O-R-D, and you send that to 78070. Please do that now. Believe me, it's a cracking read.
Anyway, what have you been reading? Stop bumbling on
now,
and
listen,
wasting time.
There's a new book out, right?
Yeah.
And this has been bouncing around for years, if not decades. Mm. The feud between the Adidas and Puma brothers, okay?
Oh, yes.
It's a great, great story. It's a new book out. In just to sum it up, I'll tell you. 1924 was the year that Adolf, believe it or not, that was...
Adolf?
Well, Adidas is called Adidas because the first name of the first brother was Adolf.
Right.
And it's a very unfortunate name to have.
Presumably since about 1945, not very many German people have called their kids Adolf.
Exactly. I don't think there's been a single registered Adolf. But before 1933, you know, when Adolf Hitler rose to prominence as the Chancellor of Germany, lots of people were called Adolf.
Yeah.
I think it's the equivalent of, like, of Alfred in this country.
I'm sure it is.
So Alf. So one is called Adolf, and that was abbreviated to Addy.
Right.
Got it?
Yeah.
And the other one was called Rudolf.
Rudolf and Adolf.
Very nice. So we had Rudolf and Adolf, and Rudy's name was abbreviated to Rudy.
Right.
So whilst they were running round in their lederhosen as little kids, you know, in those German houses.
Addy and Rudy,
come in for your...
I can see how...
What's that cabbage stuff the Germans eat?
Sauerkraut.
Come in for your sauerkraut, you miserable little people.
I can understand how Adolf and Addy gets abbreviated to Adidas.
Yes.
But how does Rudy get abbreviated to Puma?
Well, because he thought his brother had stolen his name, he looked for something like, feline, like animalistic, you know what I mean? Like a puma.
Well, a puma is in fact a big cat.
Yeah, exactly. That's
but what I'm saying is Adidas is based on Addy, isn't it?
Yes.
But Puma is not based on Rudy.
No, it's not, no. But but because he'd stolen the Addy bit, and remember their surname was Dars, you see, Darsler.
Right. Okay, so you tell me that bit.
Oh, they would call the Darsler brothers. I thought everybody knew that.
So
Addy... Das is Addy Darsler.
Right.
So Rudy couldn't do Rudy Das because the second half of that would be the same as the second half of Adidas.
That's very true.
Right, okay.
So he completely changed it.
But anyway, look, what happened was Adolf, Addy, skilled craftsman. It's a great book, this, by the way, because it goes into the terrible machinations of the war between the two brothers, and particularly their wives. You know.
So when did they fall out then?
Well, I was going to tell you what was. So they found this company in 1924, okay. And they got their big break because they travelled to Berlin because they had a little factory in a place called Herzogenaurach. Herzogenaurach, okay?
Sounds like a swear word.
Herzogenaurach is in Bavaria.
All right.
And Bavaria, of course, capital of Bavaria is Munich, as we
that's
all know.
That's where we Berlin, isn't it?
Black Forest and all that. No, so they travelled to Berlin in 1936, much to the chagrin of most German politicians at the time.
Yeah.
They persuaded Jesse Owens, the American runner... Yeah. Black runner, obviously, you know.
Well, that was the Olympics, wasn't it, 36?
Of course he was. Of course he was.
Yeah.
To wear his shoes. Now, Jesse Owen was very happy to wear his shoes because he'd arrived in Germany without any running shoes.
He had no running shoes.
No running shoes.
Why not?
Well, because people in America who were black in those days were treated appallingly. Yeah. And although he was the fastest runner in the world and all that kind of stuff,
he didn't run without shoes, though, did he?
He didn't run without shoes. But what I'm saying is the sort of shoes he was going to run in were the sort of shoes you and I would wear to go to work. You know what I mean? He didn't have any proper running shoes.
Right.
So they get there. And they give him the shoes. He goes on to win 4 gold medals. Mm. And all of a sudden, despite, you know, Hitler's disdain for Jesse Owens, right, you know, an appalling act of racism, yeah,
and fascism. Well, presumably he wasn't too keen on Addy giving his shoes to
this guy. Is the point. They had to, they sort of make out that, you know, well, they don't know where he got the shoes from. He must have bought them in a shop or something like that. Right. You know what I mean? So they never admitted to giving Jesse Owens the shoes. However, however, because he won with the shoes on, it was, it's been described as the world's first sort of sports promotion by association. Yeah, yeah. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because the three stripes were so distinctive. Because it was then Adidas.
So they'd invented the three stripes already that long time ago.
Right. Okay. Now, they all shared a house, right, when they got to Berlin. They decided to rebase their business there. But they all hated each other, right?
Yeah.
Because they argued, like you and I sometimes do, who was the most talented member of this duo, you know what I mean?
Well, you only argue about that because you want to be given the answer.
No, I don't care.
I'm quite happy to be equal.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything equal in any relationship.
Why
there has
not?
To be a superior being.
That's not true.
In a relationship.
No, only you would think that.
No. So, and particularly the wives, you know, who were bitching all the time. Right. You know, my Addy, you know, he better than your Rudy. Yeah, Fraulein. You wash your face, you
so
know.
So did each of them have a particular skill, or did they both do the same thing?
Well, Addy was the skilled craftsman. He built the shoes. And Rudy was said to be more of a, you know, a
businessman. So business he was a
business
guy.
Yeah, sort of promoted.
So one was the kind of artisan cobbler.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
and the other was the brains behind how to sell it.
Yes, that's right, yeah. But anyway, guess how they split up. You won't believe this. This is an amazing thing that I found in the book, okay? In the house in Berlin, increasing animosity, and then it came to 1943, and the RAF, I'm afraid, were coming over with 1,000 bomber raids, most
nights. By 1943, there was a lot of that going on.
There was a lot of that going on. So, anyway, so when Addy and his wife climbed into the bomb shelter occupied by Rudy's family, Addy suddenly shouted out, "Those fucking dirty bastards are here again." Now, the dispute ever since was he referring to his brother and the family, or was he referring to the RAF?
Presumably he said he was referring to the RAF.
Yeah, well, they had a dispute about who could use the bomb shelter.
Yeah.
You know, who could use the bomb shelter. "The dirty bastards are back," he repeated. Rudy believed that his brother Addy was directing that at him and his family, and not the RAF bombers.
Right.
And shortly afterwards said, you know, "I will never speak to you again." Now, the amazing thing is that because they were designated as craftsmen, they were not called up.
Right.
So, you know, it happened in this country.
Did they only make running shoes, or did they make...
I think they made boots for the army.
I was going to say, did they make boots for the military?
Yeah, they made boots for the military, you see, as well as these running shoes. So they weren't
das
called
boot.
Up. Das Boot, yeah. Well, funny enough, that's just started on Sky.
Has it?
Das Boots, you know, Das Boot is boot is boat in German.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's great, by the way. I've seen the first couple of episodes.
Well, you mean a series rather than a film?
It's a series, yeah. It's not the film.
I didn't realise.
Yeah, it's a series. Anyway, the conniving and scheming, right? What happened was, all of a sudden, these recruitment guys turn up at the house where they're still both living, calling each other bastards, not sharing a bomb shelter, you know, hating each other.
Right.
And these guys arrive and they say, "That is Rudy."
Right.
So Addy's wife is very happy to say, "Well, you want Rudy? Oh, that's Rudy, you know."
Yeah.
"Rudy, it is time for you to do your duty for your country."
So he gets called up.
"For the fatherland."
Right.
Yeah. And he said, "But I can't, you know, I'm..." "No, we have information that you do not make the boots. You only sell them."
Right.
"So therefore, you are not required to stay in manufacturing. You are going to the front."
Oh, dear.
So he really got sent to the front.
Right.
But the person, according to this book, who shopped him
was
Addy's wife.
Addy's wife. Right.
Yeah, and said, "You know, we don't want this bastard here anymore, you know." Anyway,
more room in the bomb shelter.
Yeah, it gets worse. Rudy is immediately sent to the front.
Right.
But he's told he'll only have to serve 2 years, then the Germans will win the war, don't worry.
Right.
Rudy's sent to the front, and on day one of picking up a rifle, captured by the Allies, imprisoned, right?
Yeah.
And spent the rest of the war until 1946 without being able to have any contact with his brother, his wife, his family, or anything.
So where was he taken prisoner?
In a POW camp in France.
Okay.
As the invasion started in 1944 and they moved through, okay? However, Rudy, because he was such a good businessman, still managed to make a very, very decent living as a POW by making and selling shoes to American GIs.
Really?
Whose boots were wearing out because of the long campaign.
Well, how did he make anything in a prisoner of war camp?
Well, who knows? He must have been very clever, okay?
Yeah.
And he was very good at what he was doing, okay? Mm. Now then, he wasn't released and didn't get home until 1948, okay?
Right.
And at that point, he so hated Addy, he said, fuck you, Addy! I've spent the last 5 years in a prisoner of war camp! But you bastard, you did not stop me making shoes. And now I have a fortune given to me by G.I. Joe.
So he was quite wealthy then?
Yeah, he's wealthy. He'd made all this money out of the... What happened was, when the Americans liberated him from his prisoner of war camp, he stayed for another year and made all the boots for them.
Okay.
I mean, he's a very clever guy, okay? So Adolf had already named his company Adidas, obviously a combination of Adi and Dassler. So Rudolf just plucked a name out of the sky and called his firm Puma, okay? Now, the problem was, they then went back to their base, which was the Bavarian town of Herz Ago and Arrest, okay? Because they still had a factory back there,
right?
And everything in Berlin had been smashed to pieces, like, so there was no point staying in Berlin.
Right.
In fact, funny enough, I went to Berlin for the World Cup in 2006.
Yeah.
I'm amazed how many of those beautiful classic buildings are still left.
Well, I mean, I was going to say the Olympic Stadium's still there.
The Olympic Stadium
didn't get
still
smashed
there.
To pieces.
Didn't get smashed
lots
to pieces.
Of the Brandenburg Gate and all that.
It is.
When was that built?
Brandenburg Gate was
that
was
built post-war or was that
was
before
built,
the war?
That was built over a century ago.
Right.
That was like 1890 during the...
Well, so quite a lot of it was
during
still right,
the. Who were the Germans in those days? They weren't Germans. They were called... what were they called?
The Saxo-Coburg.
Saxo-Coburg, something like that. It was when old Kaiser Bill was coming to power, you know?
Right.
Kaiser Bill.
Well,
those
the First
funny
World War, they were, still, they were still Germans in the First World War, though, weren't they? They were.
Yes, they were.
They
yes,
were
they
Germany
were.
In the First World War.
Yes, they were, yeah, but just about. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. So anyway, so what happens then is that they go back to Herz Ago and Arrest.
Right.
But they opened two factories, not one.
Okay.
It split the whole town.
Mm.
People in that town became known as the Bentnecks.
Right.
And the reason they became known as the Bentnecks, which passed into German dialect, Spenschneck, was because when you were in the street and somebody stopped and talked to you, you looked down to see if they were wearing Adidas or Puma footwear.
Right.
And if they were wearing the one that you weren't wearing, you didn't speak to them.
Right.
Because it was likely 90% of the town worked for either Addy or Rudy, okay?
Right.
And you did not speak to anybody else wearing opposition shoes.
It's a bizarre story, isn't it?
It's a brilliant story. It's an absolutely brilliant story. And you didn't talk to anybody else, okay? Now, Rudy died in 1974. He was age 76.
Right.
Addy died 4 years later in 78. Their graves, get this, are at either end of the town churchyard in... the Bavarian town of Herz Ago and Arrest, right?
Has he got three stripes on his grave?
Well, I don't know, to be honest.
he should have.
I haven't seen a picture of him. Yeah. But that was demanded by the relatives who were left, by the widows and all that, as a final symbol, it says in the book I've read, of their lifelong animosity.
Mm.
Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing.
They're utterly. And by the way, they're both billionaire families now, obviously, who own each
product.
Well,
I mean, you'd have to say, I would imagine, is it Adidas, do you say, or Adidas? Adidas?
Well, I always call it Adidas, mate.
Adidas, I think, is the American pronunciation.
Is it? Yeah, okay,
Because when I was a kid, I used to have, I always remember that one of the things to have was an Adidas bag to go to school.
Not only Adidas bag, you know, as recently as 5 years ago, I bought my niece Karen, then in her late 20s, a shoulder Adidas bag. They'd come back into fashion.
Yeah.
But what was brilliant in my day, there was a lad called Nicholas Birchall, right?
Yeah.
He was a real smart ass. His parents always made sure he had a tracksuit when nobody else did, you know.
Somebody at your school, you mean?
At the King's School Chester. Yeah. He was a right poncy little jerk.
Well,
you know what I mean?
Like you then, probably.
The squirt he was, and he had one of those tracksuits with baggy bottoms, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, not with a zip or anything.
Did you have the kind that go underneath your boot? You know, it's just a little, little clip.
No, it wasn't even that good. It was just a bit of elastic at the bottom. It came over your sock, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But he turned up one day in this pair of shoes nobody had seen. Mm. It was the first ever pair of training shoes I've ever seen.
Right.
And it was a very flat-soled Adidas white shoe with three black stripes down the side.
Okay.
None of us had ever seen one before, except on a footballer's foot on Match of the Day or something like that, or the big match on a Sunday
afternoon.
Well,
I remember getting my first pair of Puma football boots, thinking these are the Billy Bollocks. These are fucking
I had Puma boots.
Yeah.
In fact, funny enough, you know when I scored my penalty at Old Trafford against the England under-18 goalkeeper in front of 68,000 people?
Been able to remember.
Well, it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. He got beaten by me.
Well, I'd like to know who he was so we can look up what his record is.
I struck those.
You know, that might have been his finest moment.
My right foot was encased in a Puma boot.
Was it?
Which belonged to...
I was going to say, who belonged to that?
Mr. Alan Brazil.
Oh, really?
He lent me his boots to take that penalty competition.
All
right. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I haven't worn a pair of football boots for many a year. But yeah, I mean, Puma and Adidas were very much head-to-head. But you have to say now, Adidas is now head-to-head with Nike.
Absolutely.
So Puma is very
is
much...
Puma
a
still
sort of,
going?
I think Puma's still going.
I think it's still
but
going.
But it's a second-tier company,
very
I would
say. Second-tier, I agree.
You know?
I agree.
Absolutely brilliant story, though.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
So,
just excuse me.
All right.
You know, it's the old winter snuffle stuff.
Don't worry.
Okay, don't worry.
So we are,
I'm
of
not
course,
on the
in the midst of the Corky Review of Books. We call it the Review of Books because it sounds posher. Because when you call it a book review, it just sounds, you know, average. But we call it the Porky Review of Books.
Of course it's the Porky Review of Books,
We call it that because of the New York Times Review of Books, which is a bit pompous.
It is.
And is written that way. So what else have you been reading?
Well, listen, this fascinating book here, you'll know more about this than I do. I've tried to read the book, but of course it takes a long time to read a book.
It does take a long time.
But I've whizzed through it, right, and it is a fascinating book. Mm. It is called Withdrawn Traces, Searching for the Truth About Richie Manick.
Oh, yeah, the guy from the Manic Street Preachers.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Was that his name, Richie Manick?
No.
No, Richie Edwards.
Richie Edwards.
So, anyway, look, I've just picked out a bit from the preface here to sum it all up. On February the 1st, 1995, Manic Street Preachers guitarist, Cola assist, and Minister of Propaganda, Richie Edwards, left the London hotel where he was staying with frontman James Dean Bradfield before a trip to promote their bleak, brutal third album, The Holy Bible, in America. None of his band, friends or family ever saw him again, and a fortnight after his disappearance... Mm. Edwards' car was found in a service station near the Severn Bridge, which strongly suggested he may have jumped to his death. His body has never been recovered.
Right. Wasn't it just recently that they worked out that all this
book,
time...
This no, yeah,
all
go
this
on.
Time that
yeah,
they thought that he had gone over the bridge at 2 in the morning, it turned out that he'd actually gone over the bridge at 2 in the afternoon.
That's right.
And they'd got it 12 hours wrong.
Not only that, but this book raises the prospect of the fact that he could well still be alive.
Yeah.
And that he simply has gone into hermit-like existence somewhere because he had enough money.
Couldn't handle the pressure.
Couldn't handle the pressure, didn't want to do it anymore, and that it could happily, you know, mean that he's still going.
Well, do you know, we've talked in the past about Lord Lucan.
Yes, that's right.
And the fact that, you know, he disappeared off and nobody's really sure where he went.
Yes.
You think he might have disappeared off to South Africa.
Yes.
Maybe Zimbabwe, possibly the Caribbean, nobody really knows. But,
that's right.
You know, we talked about Ross Benson. And various other people
that's
that
right.
we knew who would sometimes walk up to the news desk and say,
yes.
Oh, I've had a tip that Lord Lucan is in so-and-so place.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Well, you'll remember Sheka Bhatia.
Yeah, of course I will, yeah.
He used to
was this when you were the editor of the Welsh Mirror?
No, this was, well, it's before that, actually. It was when I was at the Express.
Right, okay.
And Sheka used to, about once every 6 months, come wandering across the news desk and say, I've had a tip.
Yeah.
Richie Edwards had been spotted in Goa.
Yeah.
Or Richie Edwards has been spotted in Sydney.
Yeah,
Ricky Edwards has been spotted in Hong Kong. He's never been spotted anywhere horrible.
No, exactly.
He's always been spotted somewhere nice.
He's never spotted in Workington, was he?
No, because all the journalists want to go and find him in some paradise or
that's
other.
Right, yeah.
But then when I did work for the Welsh Mirror, there was obviously... I used to drink with James Dean Bradfield.
Yeah.
You know, the lead singer.
James Dean Bradfield? Yeah. No, I didn't know he was the lead singer. Are they any good, they must
be. Yeah, very good,
pictures?
Yeah. If and you tolerate this, your children will be next. You must know that song. What? It's called? If you tolerate this, your children will be next.
No, apparently they're a very dark group. They make,
not particularly.
You know,
I saw them live once.
Horrible records about death and disaster.
Not really.
And all that, yeah?
No, not okay. really. Okay. Designed for Life, you must know that one.
No, no. I probably would have listened to it if
well,
you see
I'm
what
gonna
I mean.
Well, I'm going to play
you
know. One for you. So
right,
you
okay,
know.
That'd be good. Yeah, okay. Because I'll
no,
tell you.
I mean, basically, James Dean Bradfield was quite a heavy drinker, being Welsh.
Yeah.
The thing about the Welsh is they like the beer.
Yeah.
And he used to sit in, there's a pub just off St Mary Street in Cardiff.
Right.
And he was always in there.
Who was?
James Dean Bradfield.
Right, okay. Even though he's very famous.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
because he's a Welsh boy, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And they still like to go in the pub.
Wonder if John Hartson went down and had a drink with him now and then.
John spent a lot of time in a pub. Aye. He's a Swansea boy, though.
Oh, he's a Swansea boy. He goes lamping people, you know, on the streets
well,
of Swansea,
he's
told
good,
me once.
He's a very good
him
man,
and his dad.
John Hartson.
Him and his dad, he told me once, him and his dad went out.
Well, he got done for kicking all the flower pots around, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. But one time him and his dad went out and they were having a night out and he said, somebody looked at me the wrong way. My dad, he just lamped him, you know, because that's what we do in Swansea. Aye.
Right, listen to this. Have a listen to this.
Yeah. Mm.
You must know this one, right?
This is a great record.
It's a great song.
It goes into a great chorus, which drifts away, if you know what I mean.
This is Designed for Life.
Is that the Manic Street Preachers?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I like that. I like that. Yeah, yeah, I'll listen to that in full a bit later on. Now, the reason why this book, you know, is... I mean, there's been several books written about this situation, but this has the support... of his sister.
Yeah.
And what she's
Richie's
done is...
Richie's sister.
Richie's sister, yeah. The book's called Withdrawn Traces, and it's written with the cooperation of Edward's younger sister, Rachel, OK? She doesn't accept what is the, I don't know, the given version of events that her husband, that her brother just went and decided to throw himself off the bridge and died.
Right.
And a lot of people can't make out if he did. Where did the body go?
Yeah, right.
It, you know, water apparently, I heard this from a lighterman on the River Thames once.
A lighterman?
They're called lightermen.
What's a lighterman?
A lighterman drives a barge on the River Thames, you know. And he said the water always gives bodies up. You know, somehow it always does.
It doesn't always, though, does it? Particularly if it's very tidal, and the Severn is very tidal.
Yeah.
Don't forget the Severn Bore, right?
But it comes up somewhere eventually, you know?
Well, no, it goes out to sea eventually. I mean, it's quite near the I mean, where the Severn Bridge is quite near the mouth of the Severn.
Yeah.
So it's not going to go upstream.
Well, it would turn up somewhere eventually, they
and
always
look at
say.
What happened just recently with that terrible plane crash for the guy from Cardiff.
Yeah, I know.
Coming
shocking.
From Nantes.
But
they
he was still in
they
the
found
plane.
One body.
Yeah.
But I was when I remember when that happened, the guy who knew the coastline, Coast Guard, I think, said that basically in an hour, in that part of the world, in that part of the English Channel,
that's right.
A body can travel 20 miles.
Because of the swirling currents and all that.
So,
yeah.
I mean, you know, in 3 hours, you'd be 60 miles away.
Well, yeah, but how did the body come out of the plane then if it did that? That body's still in the plane,
well, the
but
one...
it's hidden from view.
Well,
because they haven't been in the plane yet.
No, I know that. But what I'm saying is that, you know, a body could come out of the plane in a number of ways.
Yeah, of course it could,
But what I'm saying is that if you jumped off a bridge into the Severn and the tide was in, and then it was going out, you could be swept out to sea within a matter of an hour.
I suppose you could do. Sometimes people have murdered people and they've worked on the principle you've just talked about.
Uh-huh.
They've driven the body out to sea, and I'm talking about gangsters and things like that, dropped it in.
Yeah.
But then the tides turn and bring the body
back
so you can never actually... Anyway, look, so cooperation of Edward's younger sister Rachel does not accept the obvious solution, OK?
Mm.
So what she did is she... broke in. I don't mean broke in, but she decided, you know, as a mission. But it was very painful for her emotionally to start examining all her brother's files and books and things because he had a history of real mental problems. She says in the foreword to the book, you know. I'm not sure I accept the common sense version of events. Right, her brother. Had a history of self-harm, disordered eating, alcohol abuse in the summer of 1994, for instance. He spent time in Cardiff's, it says here, ominous Whitchurch Hospital.
Uh-huh.
Is the Whitchurch Hospital ominous?
It's not something I know much about.
It's not ominous, apparently.
Well, you could call it that, but that wouldn't be very fair, would it?
No, it wouldn't, no.
No.
From there, he went on to the Priory, and he met Eric Clapton.
Okay.
Met Eric Clapton, according to the passage of the book I'm reading here, who promised the... well, this is what the author says. The author says, at best, this guy, Richie Edwards, was an average guitarist, right? But he ended up jamming with Eric Clapton inside the Priory.
Right.
And then Clapton said, next time we get together, we'll make music
together. You could have a whole band from the Priory, couldn't you?
Of course you could, yeah.
I mean, you know.
Of course you could, yeah.
Who do you have on lead vocals?
That's right. On lead vocals, somebody like
Ozzy Osbourne or somebody.
Ozzy Osbourne, you're absolutely right, yeah. But, anyway, let me see, yeah. So, there's one passage here. It says, on Manic Street Preachers' final European tour, the Melody Maker journalist, Simon Price, not sure Melody Maker goes anymore, does
it? Don't think it does.
No.
Don't know Simon Price, either.
New Musical Express, I think, is an online version.
NME's only online now.
Yeah, that's right.
Sounds
is
gone as well.
Sounds is gone. Was told that it was a bit a bad time to go and see Richie, who was sitting on the tour bus. Simon Price said, well, what's wrong? Has he gone to bed or something? He said, and another member of the group said, no, he hasn't gone to bed. He's gone into the abyss. That came from a guy called Nicky Wire, who was apparently the bassist.
That's
okay.
Right. Nicky Wire, yeah.
Yeah. And when they went back onto the bus, they found that what he was doing, Ricky Edwards, is it Richie?
Richie Edwards, yeah.
Was actually...
Are you sure you've read this book?
Of course I've read the book.
Really?
Of course I've read the book. I read it thoroughly. He was banging his head against a window on the bus.
Right.
And blood was pouring from his head and was splattered all over the bus.
I mean, he was a very troubled young man.
Yeah.
Which is why a lot of people believe the suicide theory, because it's the kind of thing that he would have done.
Yes, yes. Well, anyway, so the sister has handed books going back to his school days... Mm. Over to this author guy, Sarah Hawes, her name is. She's written it. Searching for the Truth About Richie Manic by Sarah Hawes, okay?
Yeah.
And she refers to the diaries all the time. Mm. She points out that he was a very bright guy. He got a degree in political history at Swansea University.
Yes. Swansea University,
all right,
yeah.
Okay.
Place of learning.
And joined after the first single, which was called Suicide Alley, because he liked the idea of working with a band who were writing songs about suicide, apparently.
Yeah.
So it's all a bit odd, isn't it, you know?
Well, like I say, the idea that he may have taken his own life is not very unusual. He's not like... You don't talk about him as if he's the sort of guy that would never have done that.
Yeah.
You know, he's not the sort of guy that would never have had those kind of thoughts.
So, well, that's right.
You know,
now, in this book, there's pictures, right? And the pictures... that you normally see in a book, a biography or autobiography, pictures of smiling band member with David Bowie or Eric Clapton or, you know, on tour and all that. Some of the pictures in this book show a typical Richie Edwards wash bag with a number of condoms in the bag, clearly date-stamped 1989, when the picture was taken in 1994, suggesting he'd held onto these condoms for 5 years.
Right. Well, unused.
Unused.
Well, why would he do that?
Well, who knows? You know, I mean, we just don't know.
Right.
Also, although there was never any hint of him being, like, a cross-dresser or anything like that, the wash bag also contained large quantities of mascara, foundation cream... and double-edged razor blades.
Well, it's not unusual for a rock singer to wear makeup, is it?
No, I suppose not.
Or a rock star.
I suppose it's not.
To wear mascara, particularly.
That's right. But anyway, the thing is, the mystery's still going on there, but the sister's spoken to the author and, you know, floats the idea, could he still be alive?
I don't think so. I just don't see it. I honestly don't see it.
Okay. This part of the book that I've read, and this is a precursor to the chapter, this is to raise the possibility that lies between suicide and fantastical escape.
Mm.
Unfortunately, we cannot discover the truth. Thanks to his receipt for the Severn Bridge toll that the whole timeline of Edward's disappearance was based upon, it is, as you quite rightly said, mangled by the police.
And how did they get that so bloody wrong?
I don't know.
How can you mistake a camera time or a date stamp time...
By 12 hours.
By 12 hours.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very clear on a 24-hour clock.
That's right.
What 2 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
No, that's right. In the book, in the book, Rachel really expresses her anger. She says, it's unbelievable. And she criticises remaining members of the band... for somehow failing her brother's memory.
Mm.
You know, not looking hard enough about his disappearance, using his lyrics after he died, even though their father had asked them not to, okay?
Right.
And says that the rest of the band have never behaved with dignity and honour for his loss.
Yeah.
I mean, insinuating almost this wasn't bad for publicity. Well, you know the famous quote, you know, for Elvis Presley, death, good career move. You know what I mean?
Buddy Holly is one that we were going to be talking about over the course of the next few weeks.
That's right,
it's his kind of anniversary. He made a lot more money after he died. Michael Jackson is making more money now than he never made in his life.
That's right, yeah.
As is John Lennon, probably, as well.
Yeah, sure.
But why should the band do what his dad wants, though? I mean, if they were in a rock band, for all they know, he hated his dad. I mean, I'm not saying he did, but I mean, he might have done.
Yeah, but I think his dad was saying, give me a bit of dignity here, please. My son's dead, and yet you're making records with his words.
If he wrote the words to, if you tolerate this, my children will be next,
that
effectively means they can't sing the song.
Yes.
Well, why would they do that?
I don't know. I mean, the rock world doesn't have a lot of standards, does it?
Say, for example, if you died and I decided to go and do a live show, sort of tribute to you.
That's right.
You know, as if I would.
And use the words of Blado y Modo, the song that I've written.
Or continue to play the Cinnamon Challenge.
Yeah.
I wouldn't stop doing it because your sister rang me up and said, I don't think Mike would like that.
Well, I think you should take notes of what my sister said.
No, absolute rubbish.
Blado y Modo was a great song, you know.
Blado y Modo is a rubbish song.
No, it's not.
Absolute rubbish.
I stagger with a swagger till the pavement hits my face,
yeah,
okay?
It's rubbish. Absolutely
my teeth are on the concrete, my nose is out of place.
You sang it at the live show in Jeppers Bush, and it went down like a bucket of cold something or other.
No, it didn't. People loved it, right? Now then, I want to talk about another book, okay? Because we haven't got long left here.
Yes.
Now, this book is called... actually, I'll find out what it's called in a minute. It's called... Oh, yes, it's called Making Evil, The Science Behind... Humanity's Dark Side, all right?
Making Evil.
Making Evil.
Uh-huh.
Now, I'm going to show you a picture of the author of this, because she's extremely good-looking. Her name is Julia Shaw.
Julia Shaw. Is she an historian?
She's a psychologist.
Oh, a psychologist. What is the fact that she's very good-looking got to do with it?
Well, because...
want to read a book by somebody who's good-looking?
No, because she's writing about evil.
Right.
And evil and good-looking don't usually go together. Evil usually goes together with people like Dracula and that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
That's rubbish.
No, it's not.
You can have evil people who are good-looking people.
Well, you might
What about Ted Bundy? He was a good-looking guy.
Who?
Ted Bundy.
Ted Bundy, who's
he? He's a massive serial killer in America.
Oh, was he? Yeah,
one of the reasons he was so successful.
Well, Fred West wasn't very good-looking,
was he? No, he wasn't. Neither was Rose, to be fair.
Rose was ugly.
But in America, they have a
much... That's one of the reasons why they were serial killers. Because Fred West used to bring men into the house to have sexual relations with Rose.
Right.
And do you know what he did? Do you know what Fred West did?
No, I'm not sure. I want to know.
She had her own bedroom.
Yeah.
And what happened was, they had a plaque on the front of the bedroom saying, Rose's room.
Yeah.
But Fred was able to unscrew that while she was in there with a man being Rogerized.
That's horrible.
It's totally unsavoury.
It's horrible.
And when he took the plaque off, there was a spy hole for him to look through. And it was so gruesome, the whole thing inside there.
Because they'd kill the guy.
Eh?
Would they then kill the
guy? No, they wouldn't kill the guy
at
all. They'd let him go. They only killed children.
He felt like killing himself, presumably.
Yeah, that's right. But what was horrible was, he used to bring his daughters, when they were little, about eight, hold them up and let them watch their mother. Yes, it was disgusting.
That's horrendous.
The Fred West Roseworth thing is so disgusting.
Yeah.
That only a week and a half ago, they banned a programme on them, Channel 4.
But I thought that was because
I was about to watch it.
But I thought that was because of legal problems.
It was about legal problems.
Which I assumed were about the malicious identification of somebody.
No, it wasn't. What it was is, it was allegedly a much stronger argument for Rose West being the initiator of all the crimes rather than Fred West.
Right.
And her lawyers stepped in and said, we're not having this. That's the allegation,
okay?
But anyway, look, this... And I'll get away from that for a minute, but it was pretty...
But anyway, we're not suggesting this woman is evil.
She's not evil.
You just like the fact that she's decent looking, she's writing about
She's
evil.
Not evil, but if you remember, some time ago, you and I had a discussion live on air during a radio show, in which I said, one of these days, Mike, you'll find that all these guys who are psychologists and all that will say, you can't take people to court anymore for murder, it's not their fault, it's the way they were born.
Mm.
And it is going to come. And she says that.
Yeah.
She says, I don't know why we still pursue the route of punishing people that's been going on for thousands of years. She says, locking people up is a hell of a lot more expensive than trying to do what we should do, and that is to take them to special units and rewire their brains, because it's their brains that are are dictating the evil, yeah. not the person themselves.
Well, that's all very well, as long as you know how to rewire the brain. But what if you don't know how to rewire the brain?
Well, she says that... she says, I am sufficiently strongly viewed about the non-existence of evil that I believe you can eradicate criminal behaviour from society by getting to understand what makes people commit crimes.
Well, you can also eradicate it by locking up the criminals.
Of course you can, but she says that's a waste of time, too expensive, OK?
Absolutely.
She says we're routinely told that people are evil, and that is not just the act, it's the people. I think that's incorrect. It's a lazy, lazy thing to do in society to say that people are evil. It's dehumanising and dehumanising to others, and it makes us capable of great harm, punishing people for things they cannot help doing.
Well, I don't believe a word of that for a start. Because if you think about two of the most evil people alive, right, you think about the two boys that killed Jamie Bulger.
Yes, that's right.
You think about what they did
to
that boy when they were only 10 and 11 years of age.
That's
now, now, if you're not evil doing that, then I don't know what evil is. Because, I mean, everybody knows what is right and what is wrong.
Yeah.
And the idea that some, you know, halfway decent-looking psychiatrist can come along and say, oh, yeah, they're not evil.
Yeah.
Their brains are just wired wrong. Well, maybe the two things are the same.
Yeah. And what about Hindley and Brady?
Yeah. I mean, you can't do those kinds of things unless you're evil.
I agree.
I don't believe that.
Myra Hindley would get in her little van, right? She had a little van, and she'd drive through the streets of Oldham until she found a child on her own, usually only two streets away from where she lived, because the child had to know her. And she'd say, oh...
Just entice her into the car.
Yeah, hello, Maisie. I'm just going up to Saddleworth Mill. I've lost my glove. Will you come and help me look for it?
Yeah.
The little child would get in the car, think this is a great adventure, going up to Saddleworth Moor on a lovely summer's evening, going to help Myra, you know, my neighbour, find a glove. And then Brady would follow on a bike, on a motorbike, get up there, strangle the child, sexually assault the child, and bury the child on the moor.
Yeah.
I mean, if that's not evil, I don't know what is.
Well, exactly.
But anyway...
And the point about locking them up is that you save... You safeguard the rest of the community from their evil.
That's right.
Surely.
But this woman, this Julia Shaw, says, no, 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 once we... She says only we only understand 2% of a human's brain. She said if we could just work a bit harder on understanding the rest of the human brain, we could un-evil these people.
Well,
rewire their brains and make them non-evil. So the answer, the question then is, if a serial killer's killed seven people, even then you get him and you rewire his brain and you're certain, oh, he's not going to kill anymore...
Right.
Do you then let him go, or does he serve 50 years for killing seven people?
Well, presumably you let him go.
Exactly. Because it wasn't his fault.
Well, you run the risk of him killing another seven people.
Anyway, just as a side issue to this this last book, okay, she says there's evil in all of us, and one of the places it most comes out is in the workplace. She says companies actually promote evil amongst their senior executives. They want them to be like psychopaths. They turn people into numbers. It makes it easier to dehumanise the workers if the bosses are seen to be evil and they have to be frightened of them. There are some psychopaths in positions of power and companies deliberately put them there. This woman's, I think, is a bit off the wall, you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, she's not the first person to say that. Being a psychopath does not mean that you're a crazed killer. Being a psychopath means that you have a series of personality traits which turn you into somebody who is quite... unempathetic.
Yeah, that's right.
Somebody a bit like you, for example. I mean, you would probably, if you took the psychopath test, you'd probably be labelled a psychopath.
Nowhere near it,
I've taken it. No, you would be.
No, no.
No, because in order to be a successful businessman or journalist, you have to be a psychopath.
Yeah, no, rubbish.
You do.
Rubbish.
It's absolutely right.
I mean, I've worked for people in the past, we know what we're talking about here, who were just evil, filthy, disgusting,
but the business
bullying,
that we were in
wankers,
was
you know
full
what
of
I mean?
People who were pretty bad like that and full of psychopaths. And the only way you survive in that world and the only way that you succeed in that world is to be a psychopath.
She
There's
uses,
wrong with it.
As the last point on this book, okay, and the book is Making Evil, The Science Behind Humanity's Dark Side, published by Canongate, Julia Shaw. Her last statement here, the last statement I'll make is, she says, why is it then that psychopaths and sadists are far more likely to be a man than a woman? In part, it's because of how they're brought up. Girls are encouraged to suppress any natural aggression and behave in line with the interest of others. Boys, on the other hand, not so much. Boys are encouraged to show their macho side. Is that why men commit more violent crime than women? Because women are simply trained not to in childhood.
I say that's bollocks.
That's
as well.
What she is describing
as
bollocks. How people's brains are wired in adolescence.
She's talking bollocks because I've known plenty of evil women.
Yeah.
And there's even a song called Evil Woman by ELO.
Evil Woman.
That's what I mean. Da, 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 so, you know, there's no song called Evil Man, is there?
No.
There's no song called Evil Man.
No,
so she must be wrong, right? And Jeff Lynne must be right.
Yeah, maybe.
We're the two mics.
...1924 was the year that Adolf, believe it or not, that was...
Adolf?
Well, Adidas is called Adidas because the first name of the first brother was Adolf.
Right.
And it's a very unfortunate name to have.
Presumably since about 1945, not very many German people have called their kids Adolf.
Exactly. I don't think there's been a single registered Adolf. But before 1933, you know, when Adolf Hitler rose to prominence as the Chancellor of Germany, lots of people were called Adolf.
Yeah.
I think it's the equivalent of the like of Alfred in this country.
I'm sure it is.
So Alf, so one is called Adolf, and that was abbreviated to Addy, right? Got it?
Yeah.
And the other one was called Rudolf.
Rudolf
the red nose reindeer. So we had Rudolf and Adolf, and Rudy's name was abbreviated to Rudy.
Right.
So whilst they were running round in their lederhosen as little kids, you know, in those German houses.
Addy,
Rudy, come in for your...
I can see
what's
how...
What's that cabbage stuff the Germans eat?
Sauerkraut.
Come in for your sauerkraut, you miserable little people.
Being a psychopath means that you have a series of personality traits which turn you into somebody who is quite unempathetic.
Yeah, that's right.
Somebody a bit like you, for example. I mean, you would probably, if you took the psychopath test, you'd probably be labelled a psychopath.
Nowhere near it.
I've taken it. No, you would be.
No,
because in order to be a successful businessman or journalist, you have to be a psychopath.
No, rubbish.
You do.
Rubbish.
It's absolutely right.
I mean, I've worked for people in the past, we know we're talking about here, who were just evil, filthy, disgusting,
but the business
bullying,
that we were in
wankers,
was
you know
full
what I mean?
Of people who were pretty bad like that and full of psychopaths. And the only way you survive in that world and the only way that you succeed in that world is to be a psychopath.
And he suddenly shouted out, "Those fucking dirty bastards are here again."